So thank you all for coming out, our future Rain Garden ambassadors here in Rumson. It's perfect weather for why we need rain gardens tonight, right? So thank you for braving the rain. So tonight is the first of two sessions we're going to have you all be certified Rain Garden ambassadors. The second session will be later in the spring and will be an on-site where we'll look at an existing rain garden, evaluate it, and potentially look for sites for new rain gardens on those locations. And tonight is an overview about rain gardens, why we need them. And Lucia will tell you more about that. And we're pleased to be able to hold this program based on a few amazing grants that we received from Sustainable New Jersey, PSE&G, New Jersey American Water, and the Garden Club of America. So we're really lucky to have over $30,000 to be able to put together this program and to implement some rain gardens. Thank you. to implement green infrastructure here in Rumson. We're surrounded by water, and it's very important to keep that water clean. And as we know, green infrastructure is a great way to help manage the stormwater runoff and also help clean the water as it goes into the rivers. So we have already installed a rain garden at the Forestdale Middle School, and the curriculum in the sixth grade classes are working with green infrastructure and rain gardens and stormwater management. We're putting in a rain garden at Victory Park that will be going in the spring. And then at Riverside Park to hit the Shrewsbury River, we'll be putting in a filter strip of native plants to capture runoff from the ball fields that are there. And then that'll be potentially another site for an additional rain garden down the road. So we have a lot in the works. But we're so glad to have you guys here to be our ambassadors and to help us not only manage the rain gardens we're going to be putting in, but promote the whole concept of green infrastructure and its importance. I'm going to introduce Lucia from the American Littoral Society. For those of you that don't know, the American Littoral Society promotes the study and conservation of marine life and habitat, protects the coast from harm, and empowers others to do the same. And Lucia is the program director for the Delaware Bay Watershed. She's presented with us before, but we're happy to have her back again to kick off this program. So here you go.
Thanks, Heather. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Fantastic. All right. Hey, y'all. I'm Lucia Osborne, Del Bay Program Director for the American Littoral Society. And much of my role is stormwater management, which is why I'm here today. And you are all here today to learn how to become ambassadors for rain gardens. So your AC has shown excellent leadership in installing rain gardens in your community already, and now they're working to mobilize all of you and have people understand why these projects are so important, how you can maintain them, how you can keep them going, and how you can get people excited about them. So my goal today is just to give you the information that you need to do that and to meet those goals. So, let's see if I can work this button. No? Okay. So the topics that we're going to cover today are just a brief introduction to rain gardens and green stormwater infrastructure. Now, I did teach a design workshop here before. Was anybody here at that workshop? Awesome. Okay, well, thank you for the people who are back for round two. I will still kind of briefly cover the design and introduction just for anyone who wasn't there, but I won't be as in-depth as last time. That presentation is recorded on the EC's website, so if you want more details about design, you can definitely go there and check that out. We're going to talk about why native plants are so important and the benefits that they can provide. I'm going to, again, touch on those installation basics. I want to talk about maintenance and troubleshooting as well with you all. If you're going to be ambassadors, people are going to come to you with their problems. And you need to have an idea of how you can fix those problems. And you need to have an idea of why those problems are occurring. So if you can see what you might have to deal with now, then you can A, prevent them, and B, know how to manage them if they do come up. I'm also going to talk about keeping your neighbors happy. Rain gardens are a different type of landscaping, and you know what, sometimes they look a little natural, sometimes they look a little wild, and that's something that it takes a little bit of adjustment. And there are different strategies that you can use to communicate with your neighbors about why your garden or your lawn or your meadow looks the way it does, and ways that you can present it so that it's more acceptable and people are more excited about it instead of seeing it as like, hey, they need to mow the lawn over there. And then I've also got a handful of resources that will be helpful in designing projects, troubleshooting, choosing plans, so I can go through those as well with you all. All right, so again, we want to just talk about why stormwater is important. Does anybody know what stormwater is, or does everybody know that already? Anybody want to tell me? Right, exactly. So, you know, it rains, it's raining right now, and it's going to happen all the time, it's going to keep happening. There are several reports from NOAA that say that we're going to get more and more rain due to climate change, which is happening right now. So we need to be prepared for that, and we need to manage that. So the runoff is that rain or precipitation that can't seep into the ground like it would under a normal natural circumstance, like a meadow or a forest, right? Because we have buildings, houses, homes, we like all those things, right? I'm not saying we should get rid of those things, but we need to manage for that. So the implications of that, flooding. Flooding is going to be, you know, a bigger problem, especially in New Jersey as we move forward. And GSI, that Green Stormwater Infrastructure, and rain gardens can help to prevent that flooding. So, you know, we mentioned runoff. When it rains, it's going to either go into your nearest body of water or it's going to go in a storm drain. Now, when it goes in that storm drain, that's great. You know, maybe we have that flood protection. Maybe it's getting away from our houses and our homes and our businesses. It's actually going directly into the nearest body of water, just piped underground. So you're getting it away, but not away, if that makes sense to you all. So a couple of things are happening. You're getting this sudden influx of water in your rivers and streams, right? So you're going to have an increase in velocity. And what that's going to do is tear up your stream beds and your river beds. So when you think about a natural meandering stream, this high velocity of storm water cuts that out. So with that, you're losing all the little nooks and crannies that your macroinvertebrates or your fish feed, essentially, likes to live in and use as a habitat. If you have no habitat for your fish food, you have no fish food, which means you're losing biodiversity in your rivers and streams. Also, that stormwater is going to carry anything that it picks up along the way. So that is fertilizers, it's oil from your car, it's trash, it's litter, it's really anything that's going on. Sediment is a big one. The biggest one is nutrient pollution. So we have nitrogen and phosphorus are the two main nutrients that are often found in fertilizer. Does anybody put fertilizer on their lawn here? Good, thank you for being honest. Lots of people do it, and this is not about shaming anyone for using fertilizer on their lawn. But the important thing to remember is that your lawn acts more like an impervious surface. It has a really shallow, tight root system. There's an awesome, thank you, Kristen, there is an awesome diagram in the back which is explaining the root systems of non-native grass, native grasses like turf grass. But it works more like an impervious surface in that your lawn doesn't actually allow very much water to percolate through it. So it's still running off and carrying that fertilizer. What's fertilizer? Nitrogen, phosphorus, but even more basic than that. Nutrients, it's plant food, okay? So you're dumping all this plant food into your rivers and streams when we're not managing our stormwater runoff and when we're using more fertilizers than we need. So I'll talk about how native plants don't require fertilizer, which is really great, but we're gonna just stick with the impacts of this. Okay, so now we understand that we put a bunch of plant food in our bodies of water. And what this is going to do is trigger oftentimes something called eutrophication. So what's happening here is the algae that's naturally occurring in your body of water is like, hey, I have so much food. This is amazing. I'm going to eat and I'm going to reproduce, and you're going to get this overabundance of algae. Couple things are going to happen now, and stay with me because this is a little complicated, but it's very, very important. So you have this overabundance of algae. What's happening is that algae is going to die because it doesn't have a very long lifespan to begin with, and it's just part of life. When that algae dies, bacteria is going to decompose it. And when that happens, that bacteria needs oxygen to do this process. So it's going to need a lot of oxygen, and your dissolved oxygen levels in your body's water are going to drop. What happens then is you have low DO levels and you're gonna get fish kills. Okay, so there's not enough oxygen in your body of water to support the life that is normally there. So if you ever see or hear about harmful algal blooms, cyanobacteria, if you've seen, you know, Lake Hacon being closed, that's all as a result of stormwater and nutrient pollution. The other thing that happens, we've mentioned fish kills, we've, you know, mentioned cyanobacteria is there, which can actually be really harmful to humans and animals if they swim or ingest fish that has come in contact with that. But have you guys had issues with jellies or sea nettles around here? So the jellies, they don't mind those anoxic conditions as much. And also, we've killed off their predators, the fish. So that's when you're getting these overabundance of jellyfish and sea nettles, right? Okay, so what's happening is they have no predators and they are able to thrive in a condition that lots of other aquatic organisms cannot thrive in. So that's nutrients, it's very, very important. And when we use GSI, we can filter out those nutrients. So what is GSI? Essentially, it's any kind of practice that mimics nature. Okay, so a rain garden, like what you are working with, is something that captures the stormwater runoff and slowly filters it into the ground. And some really amazing things happen in the soil. One of those is that your nutrients are filtered out. Specifically, phosphorus works a little bit better with that. But anyway, so it's going to trap those nutrients and stop them from running off directly into your river or your stream. It's a really important way to help keep our water clean. It's also going to replenish our groundwater sources. It's going to prevent flooding, you know, create habitat for wildlife. So they do a lot of really, really great things. So a couple practices are rain gardens, which we'll talk a little bit more. There are bioswales, which I don't want to call them a trench, but essentially it's a narrow depression that is designed to transport the water from one area to another while slowly absorbing it into the ground. There's tree planter boxes, so there are enhanced planter boxes, so when you have your sidewalk tree, they can actually be designed to help filter that water back to the ground a little bit better than a normal sidewalk with a great structural soil and great lid. Thank you. All right, so just a little bit about the anatomy of a rain garden. Does this work? The pointer? So the pointer works. Okay, nice. So this is a very simple diagram of a rain garden. You have your roof of the building with a gutter, and what do you know? It's going to rain, and the water is going to travel down into your inlet. You'll want something on that inlet that prevents erosion. So there's a couple different options that we can go through. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But the most common one is river rock. You can do concrete forebays or brick forebays as well. But something that's heavy and sturdy that will prevent erosion. Then you have your depressed bed right here. So almost like digging out a bathtub where you're going to plant your garden. And you can use native soils. Before you do that, you're going to want to take a look at your soils. We usually recommend augmenting with what we call the bioretention medium. But oftentimes it's just a mix of sand and compost, depending on your actual site condition. So you do not need to, you know, spend $97 a yard of bioretention medium. You can use a 2-to-1 ratio of sand and compost, and it will do just as well. If you're going to make your own bioretention medium, just don't use playground sand. You want to use concrete sand because the playground sand kind of gets really, really compacted, whereas the concrete masonry sand is better suited for this. So that's just something to keep in mind if you're installing your own practices. So you'll have your planting bed. So that's your base of the garden. The center, you're going to put those plants that are a little bit more flood tolerant and collect a little bit more water. And then you have your more drought tolerant species over on the sides and on the slopes. You're going to need an overflow. At some point, your rain garden is going to overflow. It's going to happen. That is just fine. Just make sure you have a place for that water to go when it does overflow. And make sure that overflow is not directed in your neighbor's yard or at your house or any other place that you don't want that water to go. So you need to think about where you're placing your outflow. Other than that, it's difficult to see in this diagram, but you want to make sure you have at least 10 feet between your garden and the building if you're using a gutter. The reason being is we're slowly encouraging this water to percolate into the ground, and if you have a basement or foundation right there, you could run into some issues like water in your basement. So just a little bit about the plants. So we always recommend using native plants. You technically don't need to use native plants for it to be considered a rain garden. But native plants are going to work better because they live here naturally, and they've adapted to survive off the amount of rainfall that we already have here in New Jersey, right? So they've co-evolved with the other species that live here, with our soils, with our weather, and that means they can survive with little maintenance. It also means you don't need to fertilize them. We know that fertilizers are something that we want to avoid. So here I just have an example of the native range of sugar maple. The one thing that I want to point out from this photo is that just because something's native to New Jersey doesn't mean it's native to all of New Jersey. So there are a lot of really great resources. I like Jersey Friendly Yards, where you can choose specific regions of the state to help you decide which plants are best for your area. Because again, just because something's native in New Jersey doesn't mean it's native throughout the whole state, and you want something that's going to take well in your property or yard, wherever you're planting your rain garden, and you want something that's not going to need too much work to keep happy. So some of the benefits of native plants, again, they require less fertilizer. I've really just said all of this. They've adapted to survive off that average rainfall, and they're more resistant to predators and pests, and I think that's a really big one. If you're constantly having to spray pesticides and herbicides to protect your plants from the pests that are already here, you're really wasting your time using chemicals that you don't want to be using, don't want to be putting in our waterways, and you can use something that's naturally resistant. This is a fun little picture. Any wine drinkers in here? Okay, thank you. So back in the 1800s, people were trying to grow old world European grapevines in the States, and you have this nasty little aphid or plant louse called Phylloxera, and our native grapes have adapted over time to survive and not be impacted by the Phylloxera. The European grapes could not survive, so we had to grow North American grapes here. Then there was this whole issue with them carrying the Phylloxera back to Europe, and actually pretty much any old world vine nowadays has been grafted with vines that were most likely from New Jersey because of this, so it's a fun little aside. So where do you put these rain gardens now that we know what they are, now that we know what native plants are? You'll want to do an initial site inspection. And honestly, a rainy day like today is really the best time to do it, because you get to look and you can see where is the water flowing and where is it coming from. So you want to consider your roofs, your driveways, again, sheeting from turf grass, because again, that does act more like an impervious surface than a pervious surface. And consider where it's going, where it's flowing from. A lot of people will say, like, hey, I have this area in my yard that is always ponding and always flooded. I'm going to put a rain garden there. It's actually not where you want to set your rain garden, because you have to think what's going on there that this is always flooded. Either my soil is compacted, either it doesn't have the right drainage, or there's just too much water here for this area to handle. What you actually want to do is trap that water and capture it beforehand, so a little bit further up. But if you're designing your own rain garden, I think some of the easiest places to start are near downspouts. You can, pipe that water from there, the edge of your driveway, the edge of sidewalk. And just, again, look at your property. Go out in the rain. You can even take, some people have done this where you just take, a little ball, watch where it rolls, see which way it's going. Notice the slope of your property, because slope is something that's very, very important when you're designing these projects. I already mentioned this, but about 10 feet away from any buildings. You're never going to want to install over a septic field or adjacent to a wellhead. And I mentioned this too, but think about where that garden is going to overflow to. If your outflow is facing your home or facing your neighbor's home, you're going to run into a problem eventually, whether that's a very unhappy neighbor or a flooding basin. So if you have an area that you think you want to place your garden, you want to check out your soils. And in the resources, I do have kind of a how-to guide on how to do a soil test. We've also done soil tests here, actually, which were quite fun. But basically, you want to dig up some of your soil, feel it in your hands, add a little bit of water to it, roll it up into a ball. Does it roll into a ball? That's kind of the first thing to ask yourself. If you can't clump it into a ball, you probably have very, very sandy soil. If it rolls into a very tight ball, maybe you've got some clay or loam in there. The next thing you're going to do is run it through your fingers and make almost like a ribbon and see how long that ribbon is. It's going to give you a really good indication of how much clay you have in your soil. So a couple things to think about with your rain garden soils. Sand, you know, that's that largest particle. The water is going to run through that the quickest, which is really great for your drainage. Sand also holds the least amount of nutrients, which means it might be harder to keep your plants happy. Now, clay, finest particle, it's going to be very difficult for the water to drain through that in the base of your rain garden. It will hold more nutrients, but you need something that's super, super flood tolerant, and also it's not going to, if you have a very clay soil, you're going to want to excavate a little bit extra and augment with some sand. And again, that's why we advise people to dig a little bit deeper. So the average depth of a rain garden, the initial dig, is about 12 inches. The reason, now you're not going to have that 12-inch kind of pond, if you will, but you're going to backfill with some of that bioretention medium that we talked about earlier. And again, the reason is you want that good drainage. Other things to consider are the slope and how much sun your garden is getting. So you want the base of your bed to be flat. Sometimes that means you're going to have to build up one side higher than the other. But keeping a flat base is very, very important. It doesn't mean you can't have a rain garden if you have an area that has a slope. It just means that you might need to create a berm on one side to help retain the water, or install something like a check dam, which we'll talk about a little bit later, to help prevent erosion within your garden. The other thing I just want to point out is before you dig, you should always do the NJ Loom Poll. And basically, that is a free service where they will come out and mark your utility lines. This is, you know, very important for a safety thing, especially if you're, site in the garden in a public place. You don't want to hit a gas line, you don't want to hit an electric line. So it's actually the law, too. If you're going to dig more than 6 inches, please call. So just got to put that in there. After you've sited your garden, when you're installing, you're going to dig to your ponding depth, plus 2 or 3 inches for your compost and bioretention medium, and then you want to consider another 2 or 3 inches of depth for your mulch. So again, that's why you usually about 12 inches, even though the actual ponding depth of your practice is going to be, you know, usually more like 4 or 5 inches. And in the resource section, there's a couple of design tools that I can show you, and those help you size out your garden. So what you'll do is consider the area that it's collecting rainwater from, consider your soil, and then use these tools which will help you decide how large to make your garden. After you're digging, you want to make sure your base is as level as you can possibly get it, like we said before. There are tools called line levels, which are literally like a tiny little guy about this big that you'll put on a string and pull across your garden. And when we do our site visits, we'll actually get a chance to do this, which will be helpful for all of you. And you want to make sure the depth is the same across the way, or across the base of your garden, so that you have a nice level bed. You can also use just a regular 4-foot level. Again, just making sure the base of your bed is flat. That's one of the most important things. We recommend tilling it. You don't have to, but I think it just works a little bit better. If you're adding bioretention media or that sand compost mix, you're going to want to incorporate it into your native soils as well, right? So you don't want to have, you know, the different soil horizons. Let's just mix this all together. It'll make your plants happier and it'll make your garden function a little bit better. When you're planting, we recommend planting light plants with light plants. Reason being is it's easier to spot a weed and it looks nicer, which is nice. All right. maintenance is really important. I have a saying that everybody wants to install a rain garden, but nobody wants to maintain their rain garden. So rain gardens, they are low maintenance. They are not no maintenance. You still have to take care of them. And the first year or two of having a rain garden, I do recommend inspecting it monthly, just to make sure it's functioning properly, making sure that your plants are taking. And anytime you have a large rainstorm, you want to go and do a site inspection and, you know, just make sure it's acting the way it should. After a garden is full up from a rainstorm, you'll want to make sure it's drained within 48 to 72 hours. If it's not drained after that, that's an indication that your garden is not functioning properly. So checking on that drainage time, checking your inflows and your outflows. I'll show some examples of some problems that you can look out for. The first two growing seasons, that is when it's the most maintenance. After that, you know, check it once a season. Quarterly is what we recommend. Give it a good weeding, make sure the plants are all happy. But it becomes a lot more low maintenance after the plants have established. If you have an issue with your rain garden, it's usually because of one of two things. It's a design issue. So think about how this garden was made, how everything is in place, or it's a programmatic issue, meaning, you know, how are we treating this garden? What's going on here? And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So for maintenance, before you install your garden, I highly recommend thinking about all of your maintenance tasks and think about who's going to do them. So if you're working with a homeowner, usually it's going to be the homeowner. If you're working in a public park or at a school, you want to think about who's going to be responsible for weeding, watering, doing those site inspections. Oftentimes, you know, it's the students, facilities, people in your city, maybe you guys as ambassadors. So thinking about what that takes. And again, it's not a ton of maintenance. You know, we recommend watering weekly for that first growing season or two, just until the plant's established. If you use larger plants, like gallon plants instead of plugs, you're going to get a root system that establishes itself a little bit quicker. And there'll be a little bit less labor on you. Checking your inlets and your overflows. Weeding is a big one for the first 2 years until your plants kind of fill up and can block out those weeds. And it's not the most fun thing to do, but it's very important because it, you know, keeps your plants alive and stops invasives from overtaking your projects. The other thing is you'll want to factor in mulch and replacement plants into your budget. It's not uncommon to lose a couple plants the first year or two. So, you know, think about that when you're planting these gardens. Think about needing to replace your mulch each year. And the other thing is to know when you might need a professional. If you have a sinkhole, that's a problem. You need your engineer. If your garden is seems like it's really undersized or not draining, that might be time to call an engineer as well. If you work with a designer, you don't have to work with a designer. But you know, there are certain times like not draining sinkholes, or if you see cracks on the surface of your garden that you might need to bring a professional. Also, keeping records is super important. So these are the sheets that we use with our delving projects. They're from the Chesapeake Bay Landscape Certification Program. But essentially, it's having a method and a checklist to go through when you're doing your site inspections. And just make sure you're not missing anything and seeing if there's change over time, which is also very important. All right, so I'm going to go over some common issues that you might see with your rain gardens and what could be causing them and how you can avoid them. So most issues are related to drainage or water, and there are some design issues, like not accurately predicting or not paying attention to how that water flows during a rainstorm. So over here, this is one of the Center for Watershed Protection projects out in Pennsylvania. They missed the microgrid of the parking lot. So instead of the water flowing in evenly through all those curb cuts like their designers planned, it's actually flowing all the way down into the one curb cut. So what was happening there was super, super wet, a couple of drown plants, and then up here you weren't getting as much water, which affects the drainage as well. This was one of ours, unfortunately. This was Buckshootum Elementary School in 2018, and the designer missed an entire section of inflow. So this garden was designed to take water from the parking lot. They completely forgot that back end over there. So it was wildly overflowed, and we had to add a second section on the front to correct it. And we found out that happened because after the first rainstorm, we went and checked on it and saw how it was doing. So that's very important, see how your garden does during its first storm. Over here, there was supposed to be an infiltration trench. This was a, not sure, this was a project in, I think, Trenton. Not one of ours, but one of the ones that we took a tour of. And the inlet was higher than the parking lot entrance, so the water couldn't get into the garden and, you know, kind of just stayed to be the turf that was already there, and the practice really never took off. So those are some common design issues that you need to look at. Really thinking about your water flow, your inflow, and the levelness of your garden bed. So that's one other thing I mentioned before. If you have one section that is, you know, constantly wet and another section that is dry or dealing with drought plants, could be unlevel bed or, you know, an issue with your inflow. Also, there's programmatic conditions. So if you're not draining, it can be because you've worked wet soils. When you install your rain garden, you want to be working with dry soils. If you work wet soils, you're going to create compaction, and that's something really important to keep in mind when you're installing and later on during your maintenance, right? So if you're not going to go and weed and replant right after a rainstorm, you're going to wait for that garden to dry out a little bit so you don't compact your soils, and that's a very important thing to keep in mind. Also, you know, maybe it's just, hey, people want to water in the garden for the first year, even though someone was supposed to. So that's another program to keep in mind. Inlet maintenance is pretty important. So I mentioned the most common inlet is river rocks, and you can see down here. Down here, sediment built up along the river rocks, and it's not really doing its job anymore. So what has to happen there is you have to pick them up and dig out your sediment, which is pretty annoying. So one of the things that we are experimenting with right now are these filtration socks. So essentially in front of your inflow, it's a mesh bag that's full of wood chips. And the reasoning behind that is it's a very cheap way to help trap some of that sediment, but keep it out of your inflow so you don't have to shell the rocks and, you know, break your back doing it. They have prettier, fancier things that you can do, like concrete four bays. If you have the budget for that, that's great. That's essentially paving concrete in little steps in, which will slow the velocity of the water while it's on its way into the garden. And then it's flat, so you can just shovel the sediment out as it builds up. But we are experimenting with these guys, so I will let you know after this season how well they work, because this will be our first year with them. The other thing to think about is if you are maybe doing a bioswale with a slope, or maybe just are planting on an uneven surface and couldn't get it even. This was a project out in Pennington, and what they did, what the designer did here was install these check dams that I had mentioned before. And they use pavers, but you can use river rock or bricks or really anything heavy that will slow the water down. And the point of that is it reduces the velocity as that water flows down that slope in that bioswale. Because a small slope is going to give you a lot more velocity than you may expect. Also, this helps to keep the water even throughout the practice. So that's something to consider, especially up here in Brunson, which is a little bit more of a hilly area. Weeds. You have to weed your garden the first couple of years. There's no way around it. Some people think you don't. You do. If you use larger plants, again, it's less weeding, so if you have the budget for it, I recommend just starting with quarts or gallons instead of plugs, because A, it looks nicer, and B, you're going to fill out and keep the weeds out a little bit better. Mulch helps, but mulch will not stop weeds entirely. You're still going to have to do it. So I recommend once a month during those first two growing seasons. Again, that's when it's the highest and most labor intensive. But if you don't do this, you're going to end up with a garden that's full of invasives, which usually later becomes a garden that doesn't function because you have, you know, a vigilante maintenance person who just mows it down. So weed your garden so that it lasts. Other than that, I just wanted to touch on some communication and design tips. So the first one is keeping your edges clean. If your garden's edges look good, then your garden looks good. And it also prevents, again, those vigilante maintenance people from mowing down your projects, which, you know, has happened. So here is Rossi Elementary School in Vineland, and we had an issue with the maintenance team kind of cutting in, and what we just did was very simple rock border around it, and it just looked a lot cleaner and, you know, helped the facilities people who maybe weren't working on this project with the students know, okay, that's where I don't mow. Think about, we also had to, you know, work with them thinking about where their grass clippings were going when they were backing and mowing around. If you're shooting them right into your garden, you're going to have a larger issue with weeds. So that's just another thing to consider. Signage is another really important thing to consider, especially if you're doing, you know, really if it's a project in a public place or on your own. Saying that something is wildlife habitat gets people more excited, gets them to care, gets them to be a little bit more understanding of your project. You know, we do have signs that say stormwater management as well, but people tend to get more excited about the wildlife habitat. I think that's just human nature. And being neighborly, so speaking to your neighbors, telling them, hey, this is this cool project that I'm working on. You know, maybe ask them if they want to help you. Tell them why you're doing it. Talk to them about those sea nettles that, you know, that we have too many of, or talk to them about water quality, just getting people to understand what you're doing. Keeping a house built is also important. So that is essentially, you know, a post-planting plan. So it's, all right, this is my original design. Now I've got a layout of any edits that I have made from my original design. And it also shows that this is an intentional practice. So, you know, we've spoken with homeowners whose neighbors really didn't like these projects. And when people complained, they ended up showing them, like, hey, this is my design plan. This is my planting plan. These are my receipts from the plants that I bought to do this project. And these are the animals and the habitat that I'm intentionally working to create habitat for. And that really worked in their favor because they didn't really have, they couldn't say, like, oh, you're just letting the lawn grow wild when they made an entire front yard be a meadow. So that's just something to consider. And then pruning and deadheading. So I don't recommend pruning your plants, especially, a lot of people like to cut them out before the winter comes, because it doesn't look nicer. But the reality is those deadheads and the tops of your plants, those dead flowers, that's actually food for wildlife over the winter. And it also creates foraging space as well for wildlife over the winter. So I encourage people not to prune a deadhead in the fall. I also encourage people not to clean up their leaves in the fall as well, because that's all habitat and it's safety and protection for wildlife over the winter. But if you have a project that's sited in a place that is, you know, super visible, maybe the landowner just likes things very neatly manicured, then that's, you know, that's something that you can do as a way to compromise and keep people happy. So, you know, we do that at some of our projects, depending on the site. Other than that, I just wanted to show you a couple of resources. So you can check out the Littoral Society's webpage. We have some really great stormwater information on there, and there's a really beautiful guide to the Barnegat Bay stormwater projects that you can check out. Your Ronson EC, they have also resources on their website. I mentioned Jersey Friendly Birds. I want to highlight the Watershed Stewards Academy of University of Vermont Rainscaping Manual, and this is going to go on your website. You can click any of these links and access. That's a really great interactive tool that you can help to design your projects. Rutgers Rain Garden Manual, there's a couple slides from there and there, and then a lot of people ask about where they can buy native plants. So the Meadow Project is a really nice comprehensive list of native plant vendors across the country. Questions?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a question. So for the Watershed Sport Academy, University of Vermont, if you wanted to plant, let's say, Southern New Jersey, mm-hmm. is it site sensitive or is it focused on Vermont?
So they are more for sizing and siting, which you can, as long as you know what your slope what kind of soil you have, what's your lighting like.
So it's a more structural.
Exactly. I would use, for choosing your plants, I would probably use Jersey Friendly Gardens. They have a really great plant database.
Okay.
And Pat Sutton's webpage is really cool too. Does anybody follow Pat Sutton? Oh, she's lovely. She's good at the website. Really great speaker, native plant gardener, and her whole yard is really wild. Any other questions?
Where is Pat Sutton?
She's in South Jersey, Cayman.
So the new stormwater management rules, do adding these catch basins in the road that take water away from housing, does that make any sense?
What do you mean by does this make any sense?
I don't know, it's like just stormwater, but they just added them all down the street.
So they shouldn't be channeling it right into the river. If they're using biospills, they should be designed for them to go back into the ground. And the new stormwater management rules are for new development and redevelopment. So they don't actually cover retrofits. But they're actually, you know, they are interesting because it's saying if you're building a new building, you need to maintain or do on-site retention, right? So you have to use green infrastructure and you have to do it all on-site. You can't just pipe it away somewhere, which is what we've been doing for the last, you know, couple hundred years. We build them. We do rain barrel workshops. They are a, you know, they're like the gateway drug to GSI, if you will. So, you know, they will capture the water off your roof, off your shed. You have to, you know, find a use for that water afterwards. So I recommend, you know, putting them near gardens to actually use that water. You know, otherwise it's not providing like real filtration benefit. But if you're in an area where, you know, you're super susceptible to flooding, maybe you're in a CSO community, Robinson is not a CSO community, but there are people who have these combined sewer overflows in the systems, and rain barrels do help to prevent flooding and prevent those overflows.
What's CSO?
It's a combined sewer overflow system that is not something that you have in your community, but essentially it's the water in your storm drains, how I mentioned that it goes directly to your river or stream, that infrastructure is combined with the city's sanitary sewer. So the water from your house, your shower, your bathroom. And the problem with that is if you get too much rain, which too much really isn't that much rain, especially with how much impervious surface these communities have, because most of them are older, most of them are urban, you get an overflow. And what actually happens is you have raw sewage jumping into your waterways or backflowing into the streets. And actually, you know, the Littoral Society is working to advocate for federal funding to help fix this problem in the communities that have them. And that really becomes a justice issue because the communities that do have CSOs, you know, they tend to have lower incomes, they tend to have more people of color, and they tend to have fewer resources. So it's a tough issue.
If you're putting a
So designing at a school, a lot of times the facilities people have stormwater plans. And so you can, and if they don't, even doing the walk around the perimeter of the building, okay, so how many downspouts are there? How large is this roof? If there's a slope on the roof, you can take that into consideration. And then you can get a better idea of how much water is actually coming down the specific downspout. The other thing is we tend to oversize our gardens for schools for a couple of reasons. You know, we're getting stronger rainstorms anyway because of climate change, but also we like to use them as learning classrooms for the students to go out and, you know, do work in and see what's going on. But that's, again, where we're thinking about your overflow becomes super, super important, especially at school projects, because that garden is going to overflow at some point. It's and that's not a bad thing. That just It's just something that will happen. So making sure you think about where that is directed is very important. And as far as like actually physically cutting the downspout, we usually work with the facilities team storing, or we try to work with the facilities team storing the install, and oftentimes they'll do it for you. Any other questions?
Is there a maximum flow that you have to break down? On my property, one side of the mountain, where the water can be really quick. But I like rain garden, but I can't figure out where to slow the water down. How much can I slow it down before I channel it in the garden? Sort of a breakpoint.
So I don't know that there is an exact like speed velocity off the top of my head. I'm sure there is. But what I would do in a situation like that is use a series of those check dams that we were talking about. You know, we have another project at Bridgeton High School, and it's a three-tiered system because there was a slope. So essentially we have, you know, like one horizontal garden with the check dam, some rocks to help slow the velocity of the water, and then another one below, and it's like a step system. And that is something that will work if you're dealing with a slope.
I have one question about, first of all, like if you have if you do want to channel water to your rain garden, slow it down, and you didn't have like an entrance, so maybe it's a bias as well, right?
Absolutely.
But I have a question about the price, the average price of the rain garden. So if people are looking at to homeowners and they're saying, oh, I want to throw them, I have no idea how much it is. It's not like the back of the envelope with price per 100 square feet.
Yeah. So it's, and this will depend on the community you're in, you know, how expensive the nurseries and supplies are. Generally, if you're doing it yourself, between $3 and $5 a square foot, and then you can, you know, do that math based on how large the garden you're putting in. If you're hiring a designer and you're hiring a contractor to install it, then it can be, you know, 12 to 20 a square foot. And that really depends on the contractor.
And how
I would say it's significantly less expensive than a drywall. I have not installed drywall, so I can't comment on the cost of them. Also, drywalls, they don't offer any filtration benefits at all. Yeah. More money, less benefits.
Where is this list available other than on your screen?
So this will be put on the Environmental Commission's website, and you can click on any of those links and access those sites.
Thank you. No problem. I'm going to put the entire presentation on there. We have the chief's on the device, somewhere so far, so you can actually go through and have some time to
Well, thanks, y'all. You know, again, we're the American Littoral Society. Please check out our website at littoralsociety.org, and you can donate, you can join us on a walk, you can become a member, or you can just learn more about stormwater. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you all in the room, if you haven't already done so, please go and do this QR code and sign up. This is how you can get on our mailing list and the GEO's mailing list, so that you, Little Society mailing list, so that you can hear more about the great things we're doing. And also our website is, you can link to that from any of the QR codes on the signs. If you haven't been there, there's an entire section on plants. We're going to have a green infrastructure section up soon. And that's it. Thank you so much for coming. And stay tuned for the part two.
Yeah.
If you want to say anything about that.
I just want to go over the beginning. So as soon as we have a date, we'll let you know.